Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo. My guest today is Vic Avila. Vic Avila is a former special agent with Homeland Security Investigations, which is a branch of ICE. In 2011, Vic and his partner were traveling down the highway in Mexico when they were ambushed. Vic's partner, Jaime, lost his life, and Vic suffered catastrophic wounds that eventually ended his career. Today, Vic is going to tell his story, and you can hear from his words the horror of that day on Highway 57 in Mexico. I'd like to welcome to the show Vic Avila. How's it going, Vic?
Doing good, Jason. Thank you for having me on.
Now, this is great, man. I mean, we've been in contact for, what, about a year, year plus now? It's really great to actually have you on my own podcast.
Yeah, it's actually great. I congratulate you for that, and I've been following you for a while, and I thank you for the friendship that we've had online on the phone, and I know we'll meet soon face-to-face.
Yeah, definitely. That's the one thing about the interwebs and everything. You meet a lot of people, but you never actually get face-to-face with anybody for a while.
So true.
So I've given the audience a quick brief on who you are, but can you kind of go into your background? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in El Paso, Texas, born and raised there, and right on the border, which gives me a very unique look at especially what's going on right now. So first time Mexican generation, born in and raised there. My parents immigrated from Mexico, and they're both U.S. naturalized citizens now, but a very unique situation growing up there on the border.
That's really cool. So I imagine you are a native speaker.
Yeah, fully fluent in Spanish and English, and believe it or not, you kind of tend to lose that, especially on the border, speaking some of that border Spanish. And it wasn't really until I went to the university that I kind of got back into some Spanish classes to brush up on my Spanish, and I just didn't know how that was going to really help me in my career, especially when I ended up being assigned to Mexico. And I can't say enough about speaking Spanish and the doors that it's opened for me in my career.
Now, you brought up that you went to university and everything, but when you went to college, did you decide to, like, hey, you know what, I want to be in law enforcement, or what, that just happened?
A little bit of both. In El Paso, there's a strong presence of law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement. You got Customs and Border Protection and all federal agencies. And so that's something that when I started looking at becoming a criminal justice major, that's kind of everyone is on the same boat trying to get to one of those positions. I had done an internship when I was at UTEP at the border with back then it was U.S. Customs, actually at the port of entry at the bridge. They gave you a uniform, and you shadowed these U.S. Customs inspectors for a couple of weeks at a time. It was for a full semester. And it was an incredible experience. Having crossed that border almost all my life, it was very, very unique to see the other perspective of the law enforcement side of it and what these officers go through. But I also realized, yes, I was just going to say that it was a very unique perspective to see the other side. And I did realize while I was there, I met a U.S. Customs special agent. And I remember the day I was in awe of this person. Like, who is this guy? Why he's not in uniform? He's got a gun and a badge, and he kind of took over the investigation and took over. And, you know, I asked around and I asked the inspectors, who is this person? They're like, oh, well, he's a special agent with U.S. Customs. And I'm like, well, that's the guy I want to be. And the response was, yes, so do all of us. And that was kind of the goal for everybody to be that. And I was fortunate to, years down the line, almost actually from that time, that was in 1994, in 2003, 2004, to actually become one.
That's really cool. So you, did you get in right after college or did you do anything else after that?
No, my career started off as a, once I graduated, I started off as a state parole officer for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice in Texas. There in El Paso, I was a parole officer. It got me exposed to the criminal justice system in Texas. I supervised these extreme, they call it the super intensive supervision program. And I supervised violent offenders, sex offenders, gang members, got into the whole gang unit, and really was exposed to dealing with other law enforcement agencies and dealing with these type of individuals. It was a great, great experience. And after doing that for almost 3 years, I realized that I've been an ambitious person in my life. And I realized that there was a version of my job in the federal side, which is a U.S. probation officer. I had met a few of them and I did and apply for them. And after about 3 years, I was picked up as a United States probation officer. I had to move to San Antonio, start off the career there, eventually transfer back to El Paso. And then doing that as a United States probation officer, that was a great experience. It helped me so much as an agent because I knew, you know, the sentencing guidelines. I knew the other side of law enforcement. I knew the court side, which sometimes as a police officer or a law enforcement officer, you know, you arrest somebody, you book them. You kind of tend to forget that that's basically the beginning of the process. And I was able, fortunate to learn that the U.S. courts part of it and was exposed to contact with all U.S. Federal agencies, special agents from DEA, FBI, U.S. Customs, back then INS, Secret Service. And I realized that I didn't want to be writing about them, about what they did and interviewing them. I wanted to actually be out there and do what they did. And back then it was right when the Department of Homeland Security was being created. This is 2003. And I applied for as a U.S. Customs Special Agent. And in the middle of the process, I was one of the few first agents to go through an ICE academy. It was still wasn't called ICE yet. They were just kind of still figuring that out. But it was an Immigration and Customs Enforcement Academy, and was fortunate enough to be selected and returned back to El Paso. I actually graduated with U.S. Customs Special Agent credentials because they hadn't even invented the ICE badge yet at that time. But you know, got back to El Paso and started hitting the investigations. And everybody, as soon as you start, is narcotics investigations, as you can figure on the border. I was in a narcotics conspiracy investigation group, and my career kind of just took off from there. I was a very ambitious kind of agent, you know, fresh, young, really wanted to go out there, and I really enjoyed the work.
Now, it sounds like, you know, you and I have similar backgrounds when it comes to customs. I mean, I came in a little bit before you, but getting assigned to a dope group right away is an interesting experience. So I understand that big time.
So well, you get exposed. Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
No, go ahead, man.
I was just going to say, you get exposed to the reality. The academy is one thing, and then the reality of actually being on the street, you know, sources, confidential informants, real world investigations, which I loved. And I happened to be in a city that I always kind of bragged about knowing El Paso like the back of my hand because I just, you know, lived there all my life. And that was a great advantage. I also had been to the other side, to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, numerous times. So I knew the city very well also. So a lot of my interviews of these dopers that came over and got caught there or interdicted at the bridge, or if we were working a conspiracy, I was able to kind of decipher what they were saying based on where they said they were at in Mexico, because I knew the streets, and I was able to use that to my advantage. So that helped me, of course, the Spanish as well, helped me be successful in that. And that's how my career just kind of progressed. And the biggest change for me was a few years after that. I was on a Friday afternoon. You kind of learn that the government works this way. I was just told on a Friday afternoon at 3, you're going to a human smuggling, human trafficking investigations group, just like that. And I remember being so upset about it because, you know, I love working the dope angle and the narcotics. And I just didn't understand why it was me that was selected. And my supervisor back then said, Victor, you will have to learn the immigration part of this and, you know, accept it. And I had no choice, of course. And I went out there and, that's really what made my career. I kind of embraced, I was never a big human smuggling investigation kind of type of guy, but I learned the investigations, completely different, as you know, Jason, to investigation to dope. Now you're dealing with people, these coyotes, the smuggling groups, these conspiracies, they work very differently. And I got to see and got exposed to how these groups are being brought across. And then within that group, I, got heavily involved in human trafficking. And I didn't even know what human trafficking was back then and had to learn the difference between smuggling and trafficking, which are two completely different crimes. And I ended up becoming the spokesperson for the human trafficking group, and the task force for ICE there in El Paso was heavily trained and started focusing almost my entire time on human trafficking. And that's what kind of led my career down the path to eventually be assigned over to the U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez as a temporary agent. There was a position to be open over there. And I had a lot of exposure with a lot of the agents. I had talked to the agents assigned over there, and I just felt it, like, you know, I knew the city. There was a lot of violence, and this is back in 2008, probably at the peak of the violence of Ciudad Juarez, which I think at that point was the most dangerous city in the world. And I went out there and really enjoyed that assignment. The only person that knew other than my employer was my wife. I couldn't share that with my family because of the level of violence that was going on. I mean, they were killing, you know, 6, 8, 10 people almost a day. And it was kind of a surreal time for me because I love Ciudad Juarez. I grew up there as well, going there almost every weekend. And I felt safe, yet the violence and this city was deteriorating before my eyes. And, you know, I tried to do as best I could with the investigations that we did at that point. And having been in that assignment led to my permanent assignment to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City in 2009.
So in 2009, you moved the whole family down to Mexico City?
Moved the whole city. My wife was on board, took the kids. We arrived there in June of 2009. We're super excited, very, very happy. And I hit the ground running. Mexico City was the busiest ICE office in the world. And it was literally from day one, nonstop. I never realized initially what I had gotten myself into. You know, it's a diplomatic post. You become a certified diplomat. You get a black passport. And somehow in your head, you think you're a little bit more important because of that. But let me tell you, I worked a lot, and more investigations than I ever imagined that I would. I just didn't realize the dynamics of Mexico, how it was at that time. I thought, you know, I'll be attending meetings and dinner parties. Well, it was a lot more than that. We're talking about a lot of enforcement and really helping the government of Mexico hand in hand with numerous investigations. And my priority, my focus was human trafficking while I was there.
And that's one thing you don't really hear about a lot is, you know, that we do have 4 deployed agents like you. And there's a lot of them out there actually doing like real enforcement, real investigations, and, you know, putting their lives on the line. And that's kind of what happened to you next, is you actually put your life on the line and you almost lost it. And I know you and I have talked about it a lot. I know it was a real rough experience, but if you could share what happened next.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a terrible time in my life, and but I'll share it with you and your audience. In 2011, I was assigned to go and meet with our ICE counterparts from the Monterey office to go pick up some equipment from them that they were requesting at our office in Mexico City. Jaime Zapata, Special Agent Jaime Zapata, had just arrived in the country maybe a little after a week. I was actually not in country when he was there. I had arrived 2 days before this assignment, and we were ordered to go on this Highway 57, which was heavily controlled by the Zeta cartels, and we knew it. There was a lot of intelligence out there. I actually fought the assignment and challenged it because I wasn't aware of what was going on. It just kind of came up on me on February 14th, on Valentine's Day in the morning. And the official word came for me, the assignment, on in the afternoon of February 14th. And after challenging it, and they said, no, we need that equipment tomorrow. They introduced me to Jaime Zapata. I met him there. We exchanged some numbers and had him meet me at my home in Mexico City to drive out in my armored Suburban the following day on February 15th. And he did. He showed up the following morning. We take off, and we made arrangements to meet with our ICE, coworkers at a pickup point on Highway 57. You know, I wanted them to drive further this way, further south. They wanted me to drive further north. We ended up making contact at kilometer 100, which was for us about a 4.5, I think maybe 5 hour drive, and made the exchange. A lot of equipment. We fill up that Suburban in the back, and we did the exchange. Driving on the way back, we're driving on the way back, still on Highway 57. Jaime had wanted to eat at a Subway. He had seen a Subway on the way too, and he was really surprised that there was a Subway in Mexico. And I remember telling Jaime, Mexico has everything that the U.S. has. It's just a little different, but we have everything here, which makes living here very comfortable. He strived to one day be also officially assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. And I got to tell you, we had a great, great conversation the whole time that we were in that Suburban. It was never a dull moment. He reminded me a lot of myself, him being from the Laredo office, from a border town, having worked the same type of cases. And I saw a lot of myself in there, and I saw his ambition and his will to kind of move up in his career. And we talked a lot about, he shared a lot of personal information with me, not knowing him from, the day before. It was a great, great a conversation that we had all those hours driving on that highway. So now we're on the way back, and I'm still driving this whole way. We end up getting to the Subway. This is south of the state and city of San Luis Potosí. We had a great lunch. It was a beautiful day on February 15th, 72 degrees. I told Jaime, this is another reason why you want to come over here. The weather is just beautiful year round. And I threw him the keys to the Suburban. I told him, go ahead and you drive the rest of the way until we get into the city, and I'll take the Suburban over at that time, because in Mexico City, rush hour is between 7 and 9 p.m. And it gets pretty chaotic, and as you can imagine, the traffic. And I told him, I'll take it over once we get into the city. But it'll give him the opportunity to kind of get familiar with the armored vehicle. He had never driven an armored vehicle before, and these cars are, they weigh almost 6 tons, and it's a different type of acceleration and stopping time and distance and all that. So the open highway was a great way for him to get familiar with the car. And he did. So I had a lot of work to do back then on my BlackBerry. I was actually forming and getting ready for a human trafficking conference in Ciudad Juarez, finishing that up, and all these other investigations that I was involved with. So I was heavily working on that, and Jaime was driving, and eventually he's the one that brings the attention to me of two SUVs that pass us on our left side at a high rate of speed. And he notices on the second SUV that passed us a long gun sticking out from the back of one of the seats, and he tells me, is that a long gun? I look up, and sure enough, there's this kind of rifle sticking up, and this, you see the vehicle occupied by a bunch of individuals in there, and they pass us at they're going 90 plus miles an hour, and I tell him, just let him go, just let him kind of go. And they do. They drive off into the distance where we almost did not see them anymore. And then before you knew it, we were right up on them again. They had almost, you know, reduced their speed drastically to about, you know, 30 miles an hour. And all of a sudden we're back on them. And that's when they started boxing us in. One SUV right next to us, almost mirror to mirror to the Suburban, the other one right in front of us. And the Suburban next to us, the guys, you know, lower the windows, stick out AK-47s and start ordering us to pull over. They're yelling and screaming, pull over, pull over, pull over. I tell Jaime, you know, step on it. And he does it initially. And, you know, the Suburban in the front kind of moves a little bit and we try to get away a little bit. The Suburban just doesn't accelerate that fast. And, eventually they're right back on us and so close that they're almost crashing us, on Jaime's driver's side. And eventually forcing us to the shoulder or the right shoulder of the highway and, force us to stop. They basically do a rolling roadblock on us. And we stopped there. You know, Jaime did put the vehicle in park and unlocked the doors. We were very surprised by that. These 8 to 10 individuals get out. They surround the Suburban kind of like in a U fashion form initially. And one of them comes out straight out to Jaime's door, opens the door and swings it wide open. And Jaime immediately grabs the handle, this industrial handle that's on these Suburbans because the armored doors are so heavy, grabs it and shuts it right back. And we start hitting that lock button and they're just yelling and screaming. And all of this is in Spanish. Get out, open the door, get out, open the door. We have our hands up, clearly visible, you know, almost, you know, right up on the windshield. And I'm yelling at them. I'm screaming at them that we are Americans. You are not who we think we are. You are mistaking us. This is a diplomatic vehicle. We are from the U.S. Embassy. We're Americans. Anything that I could think of to try to identify ourselves, I asked them, let me have the opportunity to show you my diplomatic passport. But they wouldn't hear of it. These guys, these ETA cartels had evil in their eyes. And, during that whole commotion, before you knew it, there was two guns introduced on my window. My window, that armored window had lowered about 2 inches on my side. During the struggle with trying to lock the doors, we inadvertently lowered the window to my side. We had noticed that. Until they introduced those two, an AK-47 and a handgun. And I raised the window and caught the barrels of the two guns. And they struggled to, you know, they were wiggling, the guns in there. And without notice, they opened fire into the cabin. And, you know, I kind of braced myself up against the post, on my right shoulder, trying to, you know, avoid getting hit. I see Jaime get hit. He yells out, I'm shot. And, I still have the button, my finger on the button, trying to raise the window, with my left hand. I remember grabbing the handgun and burning my hand, just trying to wiggle it. Eventually they pull them out and the window goes up and they just sprayed. I think after all the shooting, they found over 90 casings, of bullets there, in the area in the scene. And I tell Jaime, go, 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 go. And, Jaime has started to become unresponsive. I actually grabbed the gear shift and just slam it down. And I put my hand on Jaime's leg to get out of there. We crash the SUV that's blocking us in front of us. And you guys could see pictures online. Those pictures are on there. And, I try to, you know, steer the SUV, our Suburban, back on Highway 57, but it really only crosses onto the median. I tried to pull it back on the road, but that's where it ended up. The tires were all flattened out. They were just spraying it with bullets. I was, you know, trying to attend to Jaime and yelling at him. And, you know, in the middle of all that chaos, one of the SUVs, I see them take off. Then another one takes off, but then makes a U-turn and comes right back and stops right in front of the Suburban. And two armed guys with long guns get out, And right in front of the hood of our Suburban, they look at me, I look at them, and they just start spraying the front windshield. And I'm just, that's the part where I just froze and realized that the windshield was protecting us. And they ran back in the SUV and took off. I'm trying to attend to Jaime. I noticed the wound in his leg. I'm trying to stop some of that bleeding. He's bleeding profusely there. I get on the phone. I call the U.S. Embassy. There's a recorded phone call, about a 20-second phone call where I call them, identify myself as an ICE special agent, and to contact my supervisor. And I knew we were on Highway 57. I just didn't know exactly what kilometer marker we were at. And eventually, I talked to the embassy, and I even called the my counterpart in Mexico, the government of Mexico, our vetted team, the head of our vetted team unit that I work very closely, Mexican Federal Police. I called him. He dispatched a helicopter to me. I was able to, at one point, give him the GPS coordinates from my GPS and my Suburban to give him the location of where we're at. I remember in the middle of one of those conversations with one of my ICE agents that was at the U.S. Embassy, who was an ex-paramedic, was telling me to check myself to see if I had been hit. And I hadn't realized that I had until then. And so, I physically checked myself. I see that I had been hit in my chest. And then, of course, my leg. I didn't realize the second bullet in my lower leg until I got to the hospital. But it was a very, very long time of being on that road by ourselves, about 40 minutes until help arrived. And the helicopter landed there. The Mexican Federal Police, Army, and military showed up and eventually transported us to the nearest hospital in San Luis Potosí. And they took Jaime in to surgery. They took me to a different room. About half an hour, 30 minutes later, one of the doctors there at the hospital comes over and tells me your partner has expired. And he says it in Spanish. And I didn't appreciate the word that he used. I was very, very, as you can imagine, just high up on adrenaline. I was very upset. They didn't know who we were. This whole time, the hospital assumed that we were Mexican Federal Police officers. They don't know that we were Americans, and I didn't tell them. I didn't identify myself. I was so afraid. That's probably the point in this whole shooting, where the fear set in for me, was at the hospital, because I had investigated these cases where the cartels go back to the hospital and finish people off, and they knew that I had survived. They were going to come and get me here. And so I was just petrified. I remember being on the phone with the Mexican Federal Police and telling them, please send people here and then to protect us from at the hospital. And they kept on saying, yes, they're on their way. They're on their way. And eventually, another Black Hawk lands there, and, their equivalency of the SWAT team shows up. They secure the hospital. They come into the room. They say, you're Victor Avila. I say, yes, I am. It says, you are secure now. I then I remember kind of yelling at the staff there at the hospital, just telling them, my name is Victor Avila. I'm an American. I'm a U.S. special agent, a criminal investigator assigned to the U.S. Embassy. And you could tell the reaction of the hospital was like, they knew they had an international incident in their hands. But we had great treatment, great, great, great care. I asked them to please treat Jaime with dignity. And eventually, after I was initially in the trauma unit treated, I got moved up to a higher room. And I think the first American showed up about 4 hours later. So it was an ordeal, Jason. It was a very traumatic event. And then, of course, we could talk about how my family was then extracted from Mexico because of the threat that existed. So that then went on how to get my wife and kids out safely back to the U.S.
Wow, bro. I just have no words. I can't even imagine that. I mean, I've known your story, but I never, you know, I never heard it from your voice. Never heard you tell me the whole thing. It just, I can't imagine going through that, man. It's crazy. So you're injured now. And what happens next? You get, everybody gets extracted. You end up in a U.S. hospital.
I ended up, in Houston, with a great medical staff there. I was flown with it from a DEA plane, actually from San Luis Potosí to Houston. And then eventually met up with my family after I was released there back in El Paso. And that's a different nightmare that kind of begins for me with my agency that the way that I just describe it is a complete and utter failure of me and my family. I didn't expect much. I just kind of wanted to be taken care of, you know, after going through this traumatic event and being shot in the line of duty in a foreign country. But that didn't happen. Unfortunately, we went to Jaime's funeral. And then after that, they told us, listen, you can't be anywhere near the U.S. border. You got to get out. So they sent us to D.C. And that's actually where I did my physical rehab. I was in wheelchair and crutches. And that's where I, you know, had to enroll my kids in school. My wife and I had to look for a place to live. They had just put us up in a hotel for a couple of weeks. The school wouldn't accept my kids because they didn't have a physical address. Well, I remember we showed up with one bag, and my wife had been given 1 hour to pack in our apartment in Mexico City. And she packed, you know, shorts and short sleeve shirts. And it was snowing in DC.
Yeah, it's February, right?
Yeah, it's February. This is February now. I think it's February 20 something. And we need to go buy clothes. Imagine, you know, I always tell people that, you know, you left your house this morning, but you're never going to go back. You don't know that. You're just not ever going to go back. What do you need? Well, you need a toothbrush and you need clothes and you need a pantry. And my kids needed jackets and school supplies. And it's like starting all over. All our stuff is just stuck there in their apartment. It's just locked up. And so it was a very, very difficult time for my family and I to be in DC. Plus I'm going through the physical recovery, and the emotional and the psychological effects of what happened. And so it was a very, very tough time. But you know, I give a lot of credit to my wife and to my kids. My kids are resilient, to say the least. My wife as a trooper, and she had every right at one point to say, I'm out of here, to be dealing with me at that stage. But she stuck with me, and our love and all that just really came together. Eventually I basically asked them, listen, I asked ICE, you gotta get us out of here. We gotta go. And, luckily that I was assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Madrid. Just wanted to get out of DC, and we did. We left and were assigned over there to kind of finish. And there's a whole other nightmare story that continues on through there. But yeah, it wasn't a good response by my agency. They just they really didn't know what to do with me. They didn't have this in their standard operating procedure handbook. They didn't know. We're talking about financial reimbursements. We're talking about, you know, what do we do with Victor? What they really didn't No. And because of that, I suffered, my family suffered. And, eventually down the line, I ended up seeking a medical retirement back in 2015.
Well, that's the thing, is you go through so much stress, you know, a lot of police departments are used to this. You know, they have their critical incident stress management programs and everything, but it just seems like you got left out, and, you know, they have this drive on your own.
You know, that's a great point, Jason, because, I remember talking to a lot of police officers, a lot of other agents that have been shot in the line of duty, and their agencies, like I remember talking to the LA County Sheriff's Department. Oh my goodness. They had LAPD. They have these incredible programs set up, particularly for just to deal with that. They have liaisons to deal with the family. Who's going to pay the bills? You know, life goes on when these things happen. I remember the U.S. Border Patrol. The great program that they have in place for this. ICE at that point just did not have it, and unfortunate for us, we really suffered from that. And we're not, you know, it was 8 years ago, just a couple of weeks ago, the anniversary. There seems to be a lack of importance there from ICE. I always think of being assigned to a U.S. embassy in Mexico City. There is a tribute to a DEA agent, Enrique Camarena, who was killed in the line of duty in Mexico in 1985. And every year on his anniversary, there's a tribute to him. And the DEA website becomes the Enrique Camarena website. There's a room assigned, a room named after him. There's all these beautiful tributes to him and reminders to never forget him. But that has never happened with Jaime Zapata. Just this past February 15th, you know, 2 weeks ago, I was just waiting to see who puts out what. But it's another day. It's another Tuesday for ICE. They really don't care. They don't have Jaime in his memory. And so part of my journey as a survivor is not only speaking out, telling the story, but also to tell people that Jaime didn't die in vain, and also through me to just kind of educate people of what I did in my career, and also the assignments of agents abroad, and all these other different aspects of dealing with the U.S. border and security and all that. And I think that's what I'm meant to do as a survivor at this point.
Well, you're not only a survivor, you know, and the reason I started this whole podcast was to talk to people that have gone through events, you know, that they can kind of, not everybody comes out 110% on top. Some people are still struggling, and you can tell, you know, just knowing that, you know, there's not an anniversary every year for Jaime. You know, these are the things that are in the back of your head. I can understand that. And that's where, you know, kind of where you and I started chatting probably about a year and a half. I don't even know how long it's been. No, it's probably been about a year. But yeah, man, I mean, I just understand, you know, kind of where you're coming from, kind of being left out there. But no, I did not know this story.
Yeah.
And the one thing I wanted to backtrack was, you know, a month before I became an ICE supervisor was in February of 2011. And I was in Dover, Delaware. And I was assigned to the Philly office. And I actually came out there to receive Jaime's body.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I did not know that, Jason. Wow.
Yeah,
I did not know
that. That's, you know, there was a huge outpouring. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, you have to have remembrance. It's part of lessons learned, too. I mean, and that's why I love that you're out there talking about it, because it's lessons learned. If anybody hears you talk, hears your story, maybe it'll help them get through a tough time. Or maybe, like, if they happen to be in one of these situations, they think twice about it, you know? So, yeah, bro.
Yeah, absolutely. The you know, the psychological aspect of the PTSD and all that other emotions and physical ailments that I've gone through, I've fought through them. I've been fortunate enough that I've had a good support group. My medical care, I can't say enough about it. It's been great. The medical care has been good. A little rocky always with the Department of Labor, but nevertheless, they've taken care of me in that aspect as far as the medical treatment. And I'm definitely in a better place. I always tell my wife that I'm very fortunate that I didn't seek alcohol or drugs as a lot of people that go through a traumatic event do. I guess my biggest vice was food. So I did gain some weight. That was my biggest problem there, was dealing with that. But yeah, my faith, my family have really brought me to where I am today. And now I just want to contribute back. You know, I did go through a bit of an identity crisis, because for a while there, when I was employed, I was still employed by ICE, but I wasn't working there. Everybody kind of just referred to me as a guy that survived. Oh, this is a guy that got shot and survived. And I kind of had to go back and remind not just them, but myself, that I was more than just a criminal investigator or a special agent. I'm a father, a husband, a son, and I had a life outside of work. Even though in Mexico, it seemed like I didn't, because I did neglect my family a lot. I was out a lot, and I owe my wife all the credit for keeping that going while I was over there. But the faith, the support of the family is so important. And eventually I came to grips with my identity and yeah, I could offer a lot more. I am an expert in human trafficking. I did a lot of good stuff. I did some good work and I want to contribute some of that knowledge back, you know, to the community.
No, that's the thing is you have a ton more left. You and I are similar ages. You have your whole life ahead of you. You know, you have your family, you have your wife, and then you also have that life, that next step. And that's why I'm real glad to be able to, you know, share your story. I mean, a small platform, but man, thanks a lot for coming on and talking about this stuff. Now, do you have anything?
No, I always appreciate the time.
Thank you, brother. Now, do you have anything coming up? From what we talked about, I think I see a book in your future.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to complete my book proposal. I had an earlier version a few years back. It didn't get picked up. And this one is a kind of a refreshed version that deals a little bit more with the current issues. Of course, the shooting and what happened in Mexico and my career is highlighted there. And I'm looking for a publisher to hopefully pick it up. Want to finish that project, really want to put this story down on paper. And I think it'll be a good read for people to find out, not just a lot about the border, misconceptions of what's going on. I could tell you firsthand, not just have born and raised there, but actually worked there in this professional setting. I have that unique perspective of the border. That'll be in the book. And I'm also, you know, open for and available for public speaking. I've done a few now. I'll be doing one for HAPCOA conference in Baltimore later in April. HAPCOA is the Hispanic Agent Police Conference Association. Hispanic Police Police Officer Association. It's really a great group of people that really try to help the Hispanic community, Latino law enforcement community. And their post as either from as a police officer, or either state, local, or federal. And so I'll be speaking before a group there. And so I'm available to speak, to share my story, and also to discuss possible solutions to ongoing issues, border security, human smuggling, human trafficking, and all that touches our border and affects us directly.
Awesome, you know? Yeah, I've seen you on the news a few times. I like it. Got a lot of good things to say. Well, with that, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but man, brother, I always do that weird nervous laugh. You'll always see that in my podcast when I hear these stories, man, because it's just like, oh, I don't even know what to say. I'm just glad you're sharing this.
Well, I thank you. I thank you, Jason, because I still, 8 years later, will run into people, even employees, other agents of ICE that have no idea what happened. They don't know that that Jaime gave up and paid the ultimate price as a public servant, as an ICE agent. And it's a shame that they work for the agency and don't even know that happened. And I'm kind of here to hopefully have his memory continue in a positive way. And I'm here to continue to hopefully educate as much as I can and share my story with people.
Well, thanks, Vic, man. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me on.